Hi, everyone. I'm Brené Brown, and I'd love to tell you about my podcast, Dare to Lead. Innovation, creativity, building a better, more just world, all of these things require absolutely courageous leadership, especially given the complexity and chaos of the world right now. The Dare to Lead podcast is a collection of conversations with change catalysts, culture shifters, some troublemakers, folks who are really daring to create and change the world. I hope you join us.
From CAFE and the Vox Media Podcast Network, welcome to Stay Tuned in Brief. I'm your host, Preet Bharara. This week, we're going to talk about Iran. Many of us have seen videos on social media of the protests that erupted over 3 weeks ago when a 22-year-old woman named Mahsa Amini died in police custody. She had been arrested for allegedly violating laws requiring women to wear headscarves. The protests are reportedly the largest to sweep the country since 2009, and many are speculating about what they mean for the future of the autocratic regime. My guest this week is Karim Sajidpour, one of the foremost foreign policy experts on Iran. He's a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Karim, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Preet.
So let's start at the beginning for people who may not be following this very important story. Who was Mahsa Amini? What did she do? And what happened to her?
So Mahsa Amini was a 22 Iranian young woman originally from the province of Kurdistan. And she was visiting Tehran with her brother. And the morality police, as soon as they got off the train, spotted her. And it's not totally clear whether the morality police stopped her because she was showing too much hair. The hijab is compulsory in Iran, or some reports suggest that they thought her pants were too tight. But they essentially detained her and they beat her badly when she was under detention. And she must have experienced internal bleeding of some kind. And shortly thereafter, she died.
When you say morality police, is that a term of art? Is that an actual subdivision of law enforcement, or is that a casual term that's used?
It's actually a term that's used in Iran. They call them the Basij, and they're essentially men who are tasked with enforcing public morality. And they number in the tens of thousands, especially in a city like Tehran. And it's very arbitrary how they can stop you. You know, one woman who is not really covering her hair, they may pass her by. And then in this case, in the case of Mahsa Amini, Mahsa's mother said that she was actually dressed very modestly. There was no reason for them to have stopped her. But these laws can be very arbitrary depending on who is the morality policeman. And the consequences, as we see, can sometimes be very deadly.
Right. And the reports are that she was, in fact, wearing a headscarf. Do you know what the details of that are?
Yes, that's, as I said, what her mom said, that she was wearing a headscarf. She wasn't even showing too much hair. There are some reports that suggest that they detained her because she was wearing trousers that were a little bit too tight. But, you know, bigger picture, the hijab, the mandatory hijab, headscarf for women, is really, I would argue, one of the three ideological pillars left of the Iranian regime, the other two being death to America and death to Israel. And so for, you know, many people ask, well, what's the big deal? Like, why don't they just allow women to wear headscarves? But if you're an authoritarian regime and you've placed so much of your identity in this symbol of the mandatory headscarf, and that begins to crumble, you start to worry about your stability. My friend Mahsa Alinejad, the women's rights activist in Brooklyn, has been comparing the mandatory hijab in Iran to the Berlin Wall. And her argument is, you know, once the Berlin Wall fell down, those authoritarian regimes soon after collapsed. And that is, I think, what is really existential at the moment for the Islamic Republic, this idea that the mandatory hijab is starting to crumble.
As a matter of background, how free is the flow of information in Iran? How are people in the country finding out about Mahsa's death in custody and the protests and where to protest? I thought that information wasn't flowing very freely. How are people protesting in an organized way?
During times of tumult, the regime is very good at repression and information repression. So throttling the internet, preventing people from communicating with one another and the outside world. So this was a situation in which, you know, under normal circumstances, there isn't a free flow of information in Iran. A lot of sites are banned, you know, Twitter, Facebook, things like that. But people use VPNs and they find ways to get around it. And so this happened quite quickly. You know, there's been, for many years, there's been political, social, economic discontent in Iran. And the killing of Mahsa Amini was basically the match that triggered this uprising. And it took the regime a few days to try to control things again. And there was a report yesterday in the Washington Post that essentially between 3 p.m. and 1 a.m., the internet barely works in Iran. And most sites like WhatsApp and Telegram, this communication tools that people use, have trickled to a crawl. So it is now very difficult for people to get out videos and photos of what's going on.
Is there an investigation, or at least one that's been announced, into her death or not?
I believe the president of Iran did announce an investigation, but, you know, there's now a 43-year history of these types of indignities and crimes happening, and there's never been accountability. So I think at this point, people feel like, you know, we're no longer going to fall for this. And, you know, bigger picture, I think for many years, people hoped that the Islamic Republic of Iran could reform itself into a more moderate system. And I think that very, very few people still believe in the possibility that this regime is capable of reforming its politics or reforming its ideology.
Can you give us a sense of the scope and size and remarkable nature of these protests? How many people in what parts of the country and how unusual it is?
So reports suggest that these protests have happened in over 80 cities throughout the country. It's difficult to get a sense of, you know, how many people we're talking, but certainly in the hundreds of thousands. And this isn't new in Iran. Since from 2009 to the present, we've had three major national protests. In 2009, the trigger was political when then President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, his re-election as president was rigged. That triggered millions of people to take to the streets and the so-called Green Movement, which was eventually crushed. In 2019, the trigger for a national uprising was economic. Removal of subsidies, increase in gas prices caused people to go to the streets because of economic discontents. And as we've talked about this time around in 2022, the trigger has been social, the killing of Mahsa Amini. And I think the bigger picture is that what's somewhat unique about the Islamic Republic of Iran is it's not only politically authoritarian, but it's also economically and socially authoritarian. They don't only say, you know, you're not free to express yourself politically, but they police your life socially. You know, whom you can you go out in the, you can't go out in the streets with your easily with your boyfriend or girlfriend, what you listen to, what you watch, what you drink. And then, you know, economically, it's just one of the worst managed countries in the world. And so for that reason, there's this collection of grievances that people have, which span politics, economics, and social.
Because these protests were provoked by a social issue, are the participants in the protests, generally speaking, more diverse? People from lower incomes and higher incomes, and does that give it more force?
So the most vivid videos and images of these protests so far have been young women. And one of the powerful slogans to come out of these protests has been this chant of Zan Zendegi Azadi, which means woman, life, freedom. I would argue, though, that, you know, if these protests are going to lead to any type of change in Iran, the burden can't only be on these young girls. And obviously, it's not just young girls. You have young men as well. And as I said, in a diverse array of cities and social classes. But I think if these protests are going to be more impactful, you may need to start to see strikes from, you know, the merchant classes, the bazaar, from oil workers. These were the types of highly impactful tactics which helped bring down the Ancien regime in 1979, the Shah of Iran.
You mentioned one of the slogans at the protests, woman, life, freedom. One of the other things that I've heard reported that's being chanted is death to the dictator. And I guess my question is, given how repressive the regime is, how intolerant they must be about with respect to protest, when you have people chanting death to the dictator, why have they not yet, and I'm glad they haven't, but why have they not yet crushed these protests with significant violence?
You know, the Islamic Republic, as I said, the one thing they've done very effectively over the last 43 years is repression. And they have it down to a science, and their capacity for repression, they still haven't shown what they're capable of. I think these protests are somewhat more delicate in that, you know, in the past, if it's working class men who have taken to the streets because of economic discontent, you know, you can shoot them or hit them on the head with batons. When it's, in some cases, you know, we're looking at teenage girls who, you know, removing their headscarves, and that's a more delicate protest to crush. You know, how do you do that? And these images have been very embarrassing for the regime.
So they are smart enough to realize that they would make it worse if they dealt in bloody violence with these protesters.
You know, when you study the history of popular uprisings, it is so difficult to predict what is going to happen, because you have to try to get inside the head of an individual dictator oftentimes, you know, understanding the psychology of a dictator, and then understanding the collective psychology of exasperated societies. And in this case, it's not clear, you know, and oftentimes if you react with overwhelming force to nonviolent protest, you can, you know, pour gasoline on the flames instead of water. And so I think certainly, as you alluded to, the Islamic Republic is capable of much greater repression, but they're trying to manage this in a way in which they're not pouring gasoline on the fire.
So what's the hope that you have, or that we should have, that these protests will lead to reform and change in Iran?
Well, I don't think they will lead to reform. My view is that this is a regime which realizes, you know, some of the great political philosophers in history, like Machiavelli and Tocqueville, have noted that the most dangerous moment for any bad government is when it tries to reform itself. And Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, the lessons he's learned over the last three decades is that you should never abandon your principles. He looks at the collapse of the Soviet Union, and he said that happened because Gorbachev tried to reform that system. He looks at the Arab uprisings of 2011, and he says, well, Hosni Mubarak in Egypt and Ben Ali in Tunisia, they promised reform, and eventually they had to leave, whereas Bashar Assad, Iran's client in Damascus in Syria, he didn't see it an inch, and he's still ruling. And so this is a system which I believe is not going to reform, because they believe if they start trying to reform, that's not going to prolong their shelf life. It's actually going to hasten their collapse. So in some ways, this is really an all or nothing dynamic. Either the regime crushes people and prevails, although it's not going to prevail indefinitely, or we'll see some kind of change. But I don't believe that there's any in-between reform scenario.
In the aftermath of this, and in the wake of these protests and the binary choice that you think will come about, what should the U.S. and the West be doing to support the protesters, or should they just stay out of it and let this unfold on its own in Iran?
This is one of these uncommon moments in which U.S. interests and U.S. values align, in that there is a nonviolent protest against a regime whose official slogan is death to America. So whether you're, you know, Bernie Sanders or Ted Cruz, this is a movement you want to support. At the same time, the U.S. has in the past been reluctant to be overly supportive for fear of delegitimizing the independence of these protesters. But I think what National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan has alluded to is that whether the United States does zero or we do 10 out of 10, the Iranian regime is still going to label these protesters as American lackeys or, you know, Israeli lackeys. And so my view is that one of the things that the U.S. can do, perhaps more effectively than anything else, is to try to limit the regime's ability to place a dark blanket over society and prevent Iran, you know, throttling the internet and preventing Iranians from communicating with the outside world and communicating with one another. And so there are efforts already underway with Elon Musk's Starlink to try to get internet service to Iran. And I would argue, you know, more broadly as a government, the Biden administration needs to think more broadly about what is their strategy for Iran. Up until now, the strategy has been only about trying to revive the 2015 nuclear deal, which Donald Trump exited. But I think there is a very instructive template we can follow, what Ronald Reagan did vis-a-vis the Soviet Union in the 1980s. So he talked to them, he negotiated arms control deals with them, but at the same time, he denounced them as an evil empire. He implored Gorbachev to tear down the wall, and we offered all kinds of support to democracy activists within Russia. And I think that, you know, we are capable of walking and chewing gum at the same time.
Final question to you. If you had the opportunity to address the protesters and say things without repercussion, what would you tell them?
Well, just that we're really awed by their bravery. You know, for a long time, I and so many other Iranians have thought that this is a society in Iran which deserves so much better than what it has. Essentially, you have a regime in Iran which in many ways resembles North Korea, and you have a society that's aspiring to be like South Korea, prosperous and free. And, you know, eventually I think that that gap will be reconciled. You can never predict what the outcome of these protests will be. But my view is that eventually the Islamic Republic of Iran will face the same fate as the Soviet Union. What we can't predict is the timing of that.
Karim Sajidpour, thank you so much for being with us and explaining what's going on.
Thank you, Preet. Great to be with you.
For more analysis of legal and political issues making the headlines, become a member of the Cafe Insider. Members get access to exclusive content, including the weekly podcast I co-host with former U.S. attorney Joyce Vance. Head to cafe.com/insider to sign up for a trial. That's cafe.com/insider.
If you like what we do, rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Every positive review helps new listeners find the show. Send me your questions about news, politics, and justice. Tweet them to me at Preet Bharara with the hashtag AskPreet. Or you can call and leave me a message at 669-247-7338. That's 669-24-PREET. Or you can send an email to letters@cafe.com. Stay Tuned is presented by Cafe and the Vox Media Podcast Network. The executive producer is Tamara Sepper. The technical director is David Tatasciore. The senior producer is Adam Waller. The editorial producers are Sam Ozer-Staten and Noah Azulai. The audio producer is Nat Wiener. And the Cafe team is Matthew Billy, David Kurlander, Jake Kaplan, Namita Shah, and Claudia Hernandez. Our music is by Andrew Dost. I'm your host, Preet Bharara. Stay tuned.